The headlines: a study by the University of Washington shows U.S. police killings were undercounted by more than half over the past four decades. Thousands of gas stations in the U.K. are still running dry due to shortage of truck drivers, a crisis that has led to panic buying. And also, Iran holds military drills in its northwest region. A senior Iranian commander says Tehran does not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements and Daesh terrorists in the region. Hello and welcome, everybody. A new study shows that U.S. police killings were undercounted by more than half over the past four decades, resulting in the death figure being cut off by over 17,000. The study conducted at the University of Washington raises questions about racial bias among medical examiners and highlights the lack of reliable national record keeping. It compared death certificates with data from organizations that track U.S. police killings between 1980 and 2018. Findings also pointed to disproportionate killings of African Americans, who were fatally shot at a rate of 3.5 times more than their white counterparts. A co-lead author of the study says they realized a vast discrepancy while reviewing police violence data after the 2020 murder of George Floyd. According to the paper, the undercounted killings are not necessarily missing, but miscategorized. An annual Pentagon report shows the suicide rate among U.S. military personnel increased by over 41% between 2015 and 2020. According to data from the report, there was an increase of over 15% suicide rate among active duty service members from 2018 to 2020. The figure is alarming for National Guard members that increased by nearly 32% in 2020. The report suggests that some 580 members of the military, including active duty, reserves, and National Guard members, committed suicide last year alone. In a statement, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin called the findings troubling, adding that the trends are not going in the right direction. The document says, or rather shows, that many of those committed suicide had returned from combat missions such as Afghanistan and Iraq. Senior military figures say suicides remain a significant challenge for the Army. Political analyst John Stepling says the U.S. government is not doing enough to minimize or prevent suicides among military personnel returning from combat zones.
The preconditions for all this uncertainty and anxiety were already there. And now we are seeing, the public perception has turned against these wars. Soldiers wonder why they are fighting. And their families back home are facing unprecedented insecurity. The number of evictions have gone up across the United States since the pandemic. People are feeling an unprecedented level of anxiety and uncertainty and fear about the future. They don't feel there is much of a future to look forward to. Now, this anxiety cuts across, all sectors of society, not just the military. But I think you see in what is a volunteer army in the U.S., But it is really an economically conscripted army. Most of these soldiers are poor kids that go into the military to get on the GI Bill, get an education, and hopefully get away from often very grim towns and small rural hamlets that they are born into.
Moving on, gas stations in the UK are still running dry after a chaotic week that saw panic buying amid a fuel shortage in the country. Long lines have been reported at petrol stations despite officials' claims that the shortage is now under control and the crisis is abating. However, Petrol Retailers Association says 27% of pumps are still dry and only half of the country's filling stations have enough stock. Earlier, the government announced it had taken measures aimed at stabilizing the fuel shortage. The crisis was caused by a lack of truckers to deliver the petrol, a problem intensified amid Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic. However, authorities put part of the blame for fuel crisis on panic buying. The UK government has scrapped a job retention scheme that helped keep people employed since the start of the pandemic. The country's unemployment rate stands at nearly 5% at the moment, but many forecasters, among them the Bank of England, are expecting that number to rise as more than a million Britons are now at risk of being laid off. Saipuruza reports from London.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching. And also because the conditions of the virus taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Furiza, London.
Russia says a recent security pact between Australia, Britain, and the U.S., dubbed AUKUS, poses a great challenge to the international nuclear non-proliferation regime. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov described as concerning the prospect of Australia entering the select group of nations that operate nuclear-powered submarines. Under the trilateral pact signed last month, Australia will build at least 8 nuclear-powered submarines using American and British technology. Canberra ditched a multi-billion-dollar submarine deal with France to enter the new partnership. The move angered France, that called it a stab in the back and recalled its ambassadors from both Canberra and Washington. The EU has sided with France in the row on Friday. The bloc announced the postponement of a long-planned round of free trade talks with Australia by a month. The Iranian Army's ground forces have launched a massive drill in the country's northwestern region near the border with Azerbaijan. The drills, codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, kicked off early on Friday. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. Army Ground Force Commander Brigadier General Qumar Seydari is leading the drills. He says Iran does not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
General Haydari added that the drills are also aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The maneuver is also attended by the general staff of the armed forces, multiple commanders, army evaluators, and provincial officials. The Iranian army holds routine exercises in accordance with a detailed schedule in various parts of the country in order to test their weaponry and equipment. Political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas says Iran's latest military exercise near the country's northwest borders sends a clear and powerful warning to Azerbaijan, Israel, and any other countries that think they can violate Iran's sovereignty.
Israel gets 40% of its oil provision from Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, in return, gets 60% of its military hardware from Israel. Nagorno-Karabakh, it could make him feel that conflict with Armenia. This is this latest and powerful warning that Iran is sending out, not only to Israel, to Azerbaijan, but anybody else who thinks that they can violate Iranian sovereignty. But this one here in the Northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's being done because the Azerbaijani have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation and problems for Iran internally. Iran's simply saying here, we're not having it.
Israeli soldiers have violently clashed with anti-settlement Palestinian protesters in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media say Israeli forces fired rubber-coated bullets and stun grenades against the protesters in the village of Beit Dajan. They also attacked a similar protest in the town of Beita, south of Nablus. The Palestinian Red Crescent says more than 50 protesters were wounded. Palestinian protesters, however, managed to down an Israeli drone over Beita, which was being used to fire tear gas. Palestinians have been holding weekly protests across the West Bank against Israel's land grab, settlement construction, and its planned eviction of families from their ancestral homes. The Bahraini and Israeli regimes have formalized their relationship even further. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid flew to Manama to inaugurate an embassy there. The Persian Gulf Kingdom normalized its ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal known as the Abraham Accords. But that is not something the Bahraini people approve of.
Bahrain and Israel are taking their relationship a step further, with Israel inaugurating its embassy in Manama. Israel has opened diplomatic relations with four Arab League countries, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco. It had signed peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan, but these normalization of ties have one major flaw. It goes against the Palestinian cause.
It does, and that's deliberate. That is why Israel wanted these relationships. Yes, it's meant to further Israel's goals of marginalizing the Palestinians and ultimately removing them from Palestine.
Israel violates Palestinian rights on a daily basis. This is one major reason why the citizens of these countries Israel has normalized ties with are against the diplomatic relations. Former U.S. President Donald Trump began this process under what was called the Abraham Accord. Aside from naming Al-Quds as Israel's capital, it pushed these Arab nations to normalize ties with Bahrain. In one sense, this move is criticized for giving legitimacy to Israeli violations against Palestinians. Bahrainis have rejected this step, with the main opposition group Al-Wafaq and the top cleric denouncing the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel. Al-Wafaq went on to say that the regime doesn't have the right to do so.
It's true that probably a majority, probably a large majority of Bahrainis are against this so-called normalization with Israel. But there are powerful influences on Bahrain, Britain, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and they all are essentially forcing the issue without objection from the monarchy in Bahrain. So I think they are the ones who are calling the shots here, not the people of Bahrain.
It was not mandated by its people to establish relations with the Zionist entity. Thus, any communication or relations with the occupying regime is rejected and condemned. Our people will not accept it and deal with it as a threat to their stability and existence.
Canadians have rallied across the country on the first ever National Day for Truth and Reconciliation to honor the lost children and survivors of Indigenous schools. The event follows shocking discoveries of hundreds of unmarked graves at former church-run residential schools for indigenous children. In the Quebec city of Montreal, protesters held signs and chanted slogans rejecting the injustice and genocide, which they said were perpetrated by colonizers against indigenous people. Demonstrators argued that mass graves were a cover-up by the government.
What's going on right now throughout Canada is all these mass graves are being discovered. And this was a cover-up by the government, and we need action about that. We need to identify those children. We need to let the families know. And we also need to find out exactly who dug those graves and what kind of accountability is there going to be. So, again, this is not a day of reflection. This is a day of action.
Protesters said they gathered to honor children who were never able to return home, adding that the issue of mass graves reminds them of the impact of colonialism. Organizers of a similar rally in British Columbia blasted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for not attending the event, rather flying to the West Coast to spend vacation. More than 1,000 unmarked graves containing body remains of children were unearthed at former Indigenous residential school complexes. Indigenous leaders are yet to receive an apology from head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
After dozens of UK citizens identified as alleged hacking victims, demonstrators are disappointed that the Israeli regime firm is among exhibitors at the London event. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Dania Akkad, Senior Investigator Editor. This article is published under the heading "Like Nothing Happened: Protesters Slam NSO Group's Presence at UK-backed Fair." Stay tuned for more. Human rights advocates protested outside a major UK government-supported security show in London recently as an Israeli regime firm whose spyware was allegedly used to hack British citizens promoted its goods inside. Despite this, campaigners celebrated that the NSO group would not be promoting its Pegasus software after they put pressure on organizers of the two-day International Security Expo held in London's Olympia Exhibition Center. Meanwhile, David Hay, one of the alleged hacking victims, bought a £99 ticket to the trade show to see in person if NSO could address his problem. The company and its spyware have been at the center of controversy in recent months after a group of media outlets started publishing stories based on leaks revealing how 50,000 people, including politicians, journalists, and dissidents, were potentially targeted by NSO's government clients. In addition to leaders in more than a dozen countries, those suspected to have been hacked in the UK include a member of the House of Lords, human rights lawyers, academics, and activists. Around 400 UK mobile telephones appeared on a list identified by governments using Pegasus. Recently, the company was promoting its goods alongside other private and government exhibitors at the trade fair, as around 25 demonstrators protested outside, including Yahya Asiri, who is believed to have been hacked by Pegasus. Asiri, the former Saudi Air Force officer who left his life in the kingdom to start the human rights group Al-Ghaz, said, "The issue is more than what's happening to me. When they hacked me and arrested people in Saudi Arabia, they tortured them and sexually harassed them. They faced something that is almost worse than murder. And still people here," he said, gesturing to the expo across the way, "are still accepting they have NSO with them and dealing with NSO like nothing happened." Inside the expo, David Hay, a British human rights campaigner and lawyer, was approaching the NSO exhibit. Earlier this year, Hay learned that his phone had been hacked by Pegasus. "I wonder if you can help," Hay can be heard in a recording shared with MEE recently, adding, "Pegasus is on my phone and I wonder if you can take it off for me." After Hay explained, he had been told by Amnesty International that he was hacked and says he shared an Amnesty report. One of the NSO employees at the booth took down his details and said the company would be able to check if he was hacked. An employee can be heard telling, "Hey, we are taking very seriously every allegation and every concern as such, and we have a mechanism where we can actually check it." "She was perfectly nice," Hay later told MEE. "I was not expecting that. I was expecting them to walk away from the stand or for me to be removed by security, or the two." But he said he would not be taking NSO up on his offer to check if he had been hacked. His local police are investigating the alleged hack and will need the phone as evidence. Hay added, "And I would never in a world of Sundays give a spy company my phone of all the silly things." Ahead of the expo, campaigners had called on 19 Group Limited, the organizers of the event, to withdraw NSO's invitation in order to prevent the firm from showcasing Pegasus. The organizers, Amnesty said, wrote back with a statement to say that NSO would not present or promote Pegasus during the event. 48 hours later, just ahead of the event, Amnesty said it received a second statement from the organizers saying that NSO had never intended to do that anyway. Oliver Philly Sprague, Amnesty UK's program head covering military security and policing, said, "We are very pleased that zero-click spyware isn't being advertised at the fair. However, we got there. That's a good result. You can make your own mind up about the sequence of events, but it's highly coincidental, let's just say. But Amnesty would like to make sure that it's difficult for any spyware like Pegasus to be marketed or sold at a UK event, while regulators play catch-up and put controls on the fast-moving sector. Currently in the UK, a buyer or seller of what is called intrusion software must have a license, but not so far for its marketing, Phyllis Bragg said. So Amnesty has called on the UK Department of International Trade, DIT, to reclassify spyware within the current trade control system such that it could not be offered for sale at UK events or by UK brokers. MEE asked DIT whether it was considering this change. The department did not answer specifically, but a government spokesperson said, "Our export controls are kept under constant review, and we will not hesitate to take action where it is appropriate and necessary to do so." The government spokesperson also said that the use of cyber espionage tools against civil society and political groups is unacceptable. "It is essential that nation states and other cyber actors use capabilities in a way that is legal, responsible, and proportionate to ensure cyberspace remains a safe and prosperous place for everyone," the spokesperson said. On his way to Exeter to teach for the day, Matthew Hedges, who was accused of spying, locked up and sentenced to life in prison in UAE while on a doctoral research trip in 2018, called for greater accountability and oversight from the UK government. Researchers say Hedges was first listed on a database of Pegasus targets in March 2018, but his device was confiscated when he was arrested by UAE authorities, and so it hasn't been possible to verify whether it was infected or not. Hedges said for the UK government to give tacit public support for a company that has been proven to lack accountable oversight and that of their clients shows a complete disregard for international law and human rights. "If UK citizens and residents have been targeted by foreign states, either there have been territorial abuses without reply or that the UK government is complicit in these abuses. Is the government then complicit in any ramifications such as injury or death? The government should defend its integrity and citizens, highlight where these abuses occur and that it is not acceptable behavior. These actors should then be sanctioned for their behavior." Back at the demonstration, Nina, a local resident and Amnesty member who declined to give her last name, said she had turned out to protest after learning about Pegasus for the first time in recent weeks. She said she is concerned that this type of spyware is only the beginning of a technology that will emerge in the coming years that will be capable of violating privacy. She said, "I don't know anyone who doesn't own a mobile phone, and any one of us as members of the public could potentially be targeted. We need governmental action on a sort of multilateral global stage to really look at this issue. Artificial intelligence, tech development, and the speed of development, you have got to be reactive. There is an urgency for them to respond to this. It's an open jungle out there."
We the people.
Afghanistan blame game.
The West's embarrassing defeat in Afghanistan has created a harsh blame game inside the United States. Politicians keep trading jabs to escape accountability in the wake of American forces' chaotic withdrawal and swift takeover of the Taliban.
And just going back to the beginning of this year, I can just
Obviously, I can't quote the titles of the pieces, but let me suffice it to say that there are numerous pieces that would be categorized as it's going to hit the fan. And but let's just for a moment put that aside, okay? Because I think any analysis of those pieces would have led anyone to that conclusion.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll try to get to the bottom of how America's awkward position is impacting politics inside the United States. With the military taking drastic steps in that turbulent withdrawal, it was natural that a finger-pointing escapade would follow, but today it is extending beyond expectations as the U.S. makes efforts to protect its reputation as an old empire. Stay with us.
We have stated many times that no one anticipated, the vast majority, I should say, there may have been individuals and agencies, so I don't want to eliminate that option, but our national security team and no one in Congress, or I would say most people out in the public, anticipated that the Taliban would be able to take over the country as quickly as they did, or that the Afghan National Security Forces would fold as quickly as they did. So even the content of the reporting is consistent with what we've said many times publicly. I'll also note something that the president said in his press conference around the same time of this reported phone call. The Afghan government and leadership has to come together. They clearly have the capacity to sustain the government in the place. The question is, will they generate the kind of cohesion to do it?
Just this past week, the blame game was extended to Congress, where a show was put up to justify the mess. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was grilled by lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, demanding answers to difficult questions left unanswered for decades.
Secretary, the American people don't like to lose, especially not to the terrorists. But that is exactly what has happened. This has emboldened the Taliban and our adversaries.
Assuming it's not classified, can you tell us where you are today?
Yes, I'm at the State Department.
Oh, couldn't be bothered to come down here and see Congress. All right, that's great. Hey,
Excuse me, sir. My understanding is that the House is not in session, and that's why the session is...
I'm right here, Secretary. So is the chairman. So is the ranking member. Mr. Chairman, reclaiming my time. Did state at any point in the evacuation process block American citizens from leaving Afghanistan?
No, we did not.
At least two Republican members of the panel called on Blinken to resign at the contentious congressional hearing.
For years, U.S. leaders had vowed to withdraw forces from the war-ravaged country, but had never managed to pull it off. Yet, in the complex power play of U.S. politics, one thing led to another, and ultimately, President Joe Biden had to do the job, and with that decision comes the repercussions. We're now joined by journalist and author Daniel Lazar to hear his perspective on the issue. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Glad to be here.
Now, Daniel, considering Secretary Blinken's testimony before Congress, how do you think that internal tensions over the U.S. defeat in Afghanistan will play out now?
I presume that Biden will pay a substantial price for the way the withdrawal was handled. I think the withdrawal was chaotic, very badly organized. Obviously, the administration had no idea how weak the U.S. puppet government was in Afghanistan, and therefore was taken by surprise by the speed of the collapse. And so I think that Biden will pay a substantial price for that misjudgment. And I think it'll hurt the Democrats a great deal in 2022, but it's very hard to tell because those elections are still, 13 months away or so, or 14 months. So we don't know what will happen in the interim.
And thank you, sir. That was Daniel Lazar there joining us from New York.
Soon after the U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan 20 years ago, America's defeat had become evident. But it culminated in the hastily organized evacuation that left thousands of U.S. allies and military equipment behind. Ending the war sparked the biggest crisis of President Joe Biden's administration, less than a year into the White House, with some questioning his authority by suggesting that others are making important decisions behind the scenes.
As in every case, ultimately decisions that can only be decided by the president are decided by the president.
Well,
of course, to be specific, Senator, there are hundreds, thousands of decisions every single day that go into a situation as complex as this one. The big strategic decisions, Those are decided by the president. The tactical, operational decisions are made by different agencies, agency heads, agency officials.
Well, I'm more interested in the top decision making. Look, we've all seen this. We saw it as recently as yesterday. Somebody in the White House has authority to press the button and stop the president, cut off the president's speaking ability and sound. Who is that person?
Infighting among liberals and blame game involving conservatives is nothing new, but it has gone as far as both chambers of Congress now, where the U.S. Secretary of State was grilled over the administration's handling of the end to America's longest war in history. Our next guest is Garland Nixon, radio talk show host and political analyst. Mr. Nixon is also an outspoken civil libertarian and First Amendment advocate, currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Oh, you're certainly welcome. I'm glad to come on.
Now, what role do you think the Biden administration, sir, and more specifically, the U.S. State Department under Secretary Blinken has played in the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan?
I'm a firm believer that the chaotic withdrawal was intentional, that the military and the neocon war hawks worked together to make sure that the withdrawal was chaotic, that it was messy, that it didn't work out well. So from now on, they're going to make the argument that the problem is not that we occupy countries or get involved in these wars of occupation. The problem is that when we leave. So if the United States says we want to pull out of Syria or pull out of Iraq, their argument's going to be, oh, no. Remember what happened when we left Afghanistan. So now the big boogeyman is going to be we can't leave these countries.
Thank you, Mr. Garland, for joining us.
Blinken's two-day testimony before House and Senate panels demonstrated how America's top diplomat was stuck with consequences of the decisions by leaders atop the hierarchy of power in the United States. For one thing, Blinken had to defend the U.S. legacy 20 years after invasion.
These are things that we deserve to know better answers, have better hearings on this. I do not believe a word that you're saying on this.
Simply put,
I do not wish to hear from you. I'm not.
Simply put, Congressman, what you said is dead wrong.
I don't wish
there
to hear
no
your lies.
Manipulation of intelligence.
Period.
In front of the camera, and not you have all been regularly advised of the intelligence assessments.
Gentleman's time. The gentleman's time has expired.
And so has the secretary.
The gentleman's time has expired.
Yes, so the, secretary.
The secretary can answer the question.
I didn't ask him a question.
You did ask a question.
I don't want to hear from the secretary.
The gentleman's time
lies
has
to us
expired.
When he steps in front of the camera.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary Blinken, for attending this hearing and for your patience with putting up with the theatrics of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle.
And I'm proud of the
In 5 hours of testy exchanges with lawmakers, Antony Blinken had no choice but to defend President Joe Biden's decision to pull out of Afghanistan. He poignantly told lawmakers, "We inherited a deadline. We did not inherit a plan from the former Trump administration."
America's top diplomat was also forced to justify the clumsy stature bestowed upon the United States, not just in Afghanistan, but in the rest of the region and the world. After all, U.S. nemeses across the globe, such as China and North Korea, are taking advantage of the defeat to remind their counterparts that U.S. imperialist adventurism is doomed to fail. Now, do you believe that the Biden administration should have withdrawn from Afghanistan, or whether it should have withdrawn in this manner?
Well, I think the Biden administration played a very bad role. I mean, and Biden himself, I mean, bear in mind that Biden was a vocal champion of the war in Afghanistan from the very beginning, from before it began. He was an advocate of the war. And he said that he said that George W. Bush would go down in history as a great president, quote unquote, because of the way he was handling the Afghan invasion. So Biden was celebrated the war. He championed it. He was able to engineer approval in Congress. He was at the time head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, therefore one of the most powerful people on Capitol Hill. And he did a great deal to make sure that Congress went along with the war. So he was an early champion.
Thank you, and stay tuned for more.
since war hawks such as George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld engineered the Middle East project, withdrawing forces from Afghanistan to end the war has been the elephant in the room. On the one hand, U.S. leaders have sought to speak to the anti-war masses, vowing to bring U.S. soldiers back home and ending the unpopular war. But on the other hand, they certainly don't wish to be portrayed as losers.
I've advocated for an end to the Afghan war for over a decade. I'm glad it's finally over. But never in my worst nightmares could I have imagined that an administration would leave and leave $80 billion worth of weaponry to the Taliban. Dozens of planes and helicopters, thousands of armored carriers, hundreds of thousands of automatic weapons, and worst of all, 13 of our brave young men and women. Never in my worst nightmares did anyone or conceive of such a colossal incompetence. Abandoning Bagram Air Force Base will be remembered as one of the worst military decisions in our history.
The general attitude changed in the Biden administration in the wake of an ever-increasing division boosted by former President Donald Trump. The Republican president clinched a deal with the Taliban, obliging the next administration to end the war, putting everyone in the government, especially the State Department, in a very rare position. Generally speaking now, what do you think the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan is after two decades of occupation?
I think the legacy, there's a couple of things. Number one, greed. Number one, the world gets to see that the United States used Afghanistan as a money laundering operation. I think the puppet president leaving, running off with, you know, upwards of $150 to $200 million in cash was a perfect example of what Afghanistan was all about the whole time. The numbers are out. Between $2 and $2.5 trillion was laundered in Afghanistan. And when I say laundered, here's what I mean. We've also found out that 90% of the money that was spent in Afghanistan never left the shores of the United States, that it simply came out of the U.S. Treasury and into the coffers of mainly five major weapons manufacturers.
Now, the U.S. may have left Afghanistan today, but the killing of civilians still continues through the use of assassination drones. In one of the latest acts of its 20-year war on Afghanistan, the United States fired a missile from a drone at a car in the capital, Kabul.
I am now convinced that as many as 10 civilians, including up to 7 children, were tragically killed in that strike. Moreover, we now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS-K or were a direct threat to U.S. forces. I offer my profound condolences to the family and friends of those who were killed. This strike was taken in the earnest belief that it would prevent an imminent threat to our forces and the evacuees at the airport. But it was a mistake, and I offer my sincere apology. As the combatant commander, I am fully responsible for this strike and its tragic outcome.
The strike left 10 innocent civilians dead, among them 7 children. General Kenneth McKenzie, head of U.S. Central Command, claimed full responsibility for what he called a devastating mistake, offering only a vague apology, which was immediately dismissed by families of the victims. Considering how the killing still continues, how do you think that U.S. defeat in Afghanistan will influence the status of partisanship in Congress and infighting among Democrats?
I think it'll intensify it greatly. I think that the atmosphere in Capitol Hill was already poisonous with Republicans and Democrats at each other's throats. This gives a weapon to the Republicans to sort of argue that the Biden administration is incompetent and overextended, and I think that will bring an extremely bitter and angry response from the Democrats. So I think the infighting on Capitol Hill will intensify. As for the Democrats, I think that the Democrats are, for the moment, are standing solidly behind Biden. But I think as I said before, the AUKUS alliance, the very provocative U.S.-Australian-UK alliance towards China will divide the Democrats.
The war made Washington spend trillions of dollars only to quit in disarray and defeat after leaving hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians dead. Fast unfolding events in Afghanistan are complicating the power play in U.S. politics as various factions attempt to evade accountability.
This was a conditions-based agreement, and the conditions were not being followed by the Taliban. They violated it in many respects in terms of not breaking their ties with al-Qaeda. They have now attacked the provincial capitals. I don't see President Trump as one who would sit back and allow a defeat on this magnitude. When I talked to his national security advisor, O'Brien, he told me that the president told him he would never allow for Saigon to happen under his watch, and that was during his administration. I don't think you'd see the same result, but I also think, you know, as President Truman said, the buck stops here. This president can't blame the prior administration. He has to take responsibility and accountability.
The U.S. tried to root out al-Qaeda militants, many of whom are now returning to power under the guise of the Taliban. Daesh Takfiri militants are still present and planning to gain more ground in the absence of U.S. forces. How the situation in Afghanistan is going to pan out remains to be seen. But what is woefully clear is America's failure, its tragic consequences for the Afghan people, and ramifications for the country.
The United States knew for many, many months, our Pentagon knew for many, many months that we were going to leave, but it appears they made little or no effort to take $100 billion worth of equipment out of there. The Pentagon likes to have a lot of equipment. They want a lot of equipment. It's not reasonable to believe that they were unable over the many, many months that they had to prepare to leave. It's not reasonable to accept the argument that they were caught by surprise, they were blindsided, so they just had to leave this equipment and run out. That's not so. So they did it intentionally. And they bashed up some of the equipment and left it there rather than take it to, again, to show waste, to show error, to show flaw, so that they could argue that it was leaving is a big mess, leaving is what's expensive.
The U.S. has officially evacuated forces from Afghanistan and may be pivoting towards Asia in an attempt to gain advantage in conflicts in the Far East involving China, Chinese Taipei, North Korea, Japan, etc. But the Biden administration is already stuck with the image the world now has of the U.S. military's inability and impotence to bring about real change.
China's President Xi Jinping says Beijing will provide more help to Afghanistan to eradicate terrorism. He's been speaking at a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, dominated by the crisis in Kabul. The alliance includes India, China, and Russia. Neha Punia has more.
This was the 21st meeting of the group that's being seen as a counterweight to NATO, but the first since the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi used his speech to urge the nine-member bloc to develop a blueprint to effectively deal with extremism and radicalization.
What remains clear is that the weight of U.S. threats is increasingly lessening in countries with anti-U.S. sentiments. Thus, this remains to be a grave challenge not only for the Biden administration, but also for upcoming U.S. leaders.
Well, I think what will happen is, where do we go next? But I don't think there will be any infighting when it comes to empire and war. The sad thing is that now, as I like to put it, it's out of the frying pan and into the nuclear fire. The Democrats are going to argue that, you know, Joe Biden is great. Look what he's done. He's ended a war. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't a war. It was an occupation, number one. Number two, Joe Biden made it clear that he was doing this so he could take these troops and this equipment. Well, what we didn't leave there, he could take and move to confront Russia and China. And the crazy thing about that is the U.S. pretty much was run out of Afghanistan by a bunch of guys in Toyota trucks. And now they want to go against superpower militaries who have the ability to defend themselves. So it's not logical that the United States would pick a fight with other world power military.
One of the main culprits repeatedly targeted over the situation is the Trump administration. President Biden keeps pointing the finger at his predecessor, arguing that he had to evacuate forces from the war-ravaged country in the backdrop of the former president's agreement with the Taliban.
When I came into office, I inherited a deal that President Trump negotiated with the Taliban. I stand squarely behind my decision. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
He points out that, after all, it was Donald Trump who shook hands with the militant group, obliging U.S. forces to leave by the end of August. Many critics of Biden argue that although they agree with leaving Afghanistan, they certainly take issue with the unseemly scramble from Kabul and the totally chaotic way in which the plan was executed. One example frequently mentioned is the Bagram Air Base.
Well, that's the Bagram Air Base is a controversial point. The question is whether the U.S., in closing its largest air base in Afghanistan, its main air base, prior to the withdrawal, therefore deprived it of the means to execute a speedy and effective and efficient pullout. And I suspect there's probably a great deal of truth to that. Certainly, the way the peremptory way in which the U.S. Abandoned that air base without even notifying the Afghan government, just leaving in the middle of the night, was a huge blow to the Kabul government, deeply demoralizing, a sign that the U.S. Had little faith in the ability of the Kabul government to hold the line.
Ever since the U.S. acknowledged the embarrassing defeat by Taliban, the GOP has changed its policy of promoting withdrawal of U.S. troops from other countries, while admonishing Joe Biden for not listening to the military. Lack of coordination between the military and State Department diplomats is becoming increasingly evident, as the U.S. government remains undecided about the best course of action to take.
No, I think the decision to withdraw American and NATO forces was a catastrophic mistake. I think this has sacrificed a strategic objective we've had these last 20 years to prevent a repetition of the 9/11 attacks. I think that strategic objective remains valid, and I'm very worried not just about what's going to happen in Afghanistan. I'm very worried about the implications of this mistake for the U.S. and the West as a whole. As our adversaries analyze what we've done here, I think we're going to pay for this for a long time.
The Biden administration will obviously have to grapple with the repercussions of the Taliban takeover of the country, both inside and outside the United States, well into the future. And that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.